seated. While this tale from Luke seems to be about money, it's really about values. Certainly, it's possible to be wealthy and enjoy God's favor. Think of Father Abraham and the thousands of sheep owned by Jacob. There's King Solomon and Lydia, too, a businesswoman who opened her ample house to Paul and the followers of Jesus. The question then is not whether we have money, but whether we love money, whether we possess it, or it possesses us. You feel me? Do we share God's concern for the poor and the vulnerable? I imagine we all do. But do we navigate in some practiced way the chasm that often separates us? Do we notice the Lazarus who's in our midst, or the one who has been laid at our doorstep, and do something about it? Do we make it our business to be the answer to someone's prayer? My friend Doris said that she founded an inner city camp for children because she had to. The idea seized her one afternoon in a dream, and she said it literally wouldn't let her go until she did something about it. For years, Doris had led the elementary school age and junior high week at Camp Mitchell, the Episcopal retreat on Pettigean Mountain near Morrilton, Arkansas. She was a hardworking, small-town, junior league mom who loved the Lord. But what she loved even more were the intense emotions and the round-the-clock hilarity and the personal transformations that always seemed to happen whenever we got the kids away from home for a week at sleepaway camp. Doris herself was full of surprises. One spring in the early 70s, she was asked to chair the annual Serendipity Ball, which had been held for decades in her little town on the Mississippi Delta, where she lived with her husband and their two children. Doris agreed, and over the next few months, she organized the committee of the First Ladies of Helena. The band was hired, the theme chosen, the menu selected, and the centerpieces planned. Then, in a burst of 11th-hour enthusiasm, Doris invited all of the families from her daughter's elementary school, which meant, for the first time in the history of the Serendipity Ball, that the event would be racially integrated. A cool wind seemed to flow through the town the following week, over the church pews, through the beauty parlor, and back and forth across the garden fences, whose gates were newly locked at nightfall. What has gotten into Doris? More than one dowager asked, not at all rhetorically. Yet the ball was held, and as Doris's husband liked to say, at least there was no bloodshed. But afterwards, a group of her mother's friends quietly suggested that Doris might find more like-minded people in Little Rock. She might be happier there. And the family moved that August. One summer, years later, while directing a camp for the children of her middle-class parish, Doris took a nap and dreamed about a very different kind of experience for all of us, where poor children got a respite from the Arkansas summer heat and got to play and swim and cook s'mores in the country, like her own children and those of her neighbors. In fact, in the dream, there was just one camp, and everybody from every neighborhood was all jumbled up together. The diocese decided to help make it happen. That first year, we bused a load of inner-city kids up to Pettigean Mountain, and the next year, we added something for their parents so that they could get away and rest too. But still, it was only a week long, and that seemed like too little and too late. So Doris and two other women created Summer Celebration, a six-week program of academic enrichment, arts and crafts, Bible stories, and sports activities for about 100 kids from several poor neighborhoods in Little Rock. We trained the older kids to be counselors. We all learned cooperative games. We offered conflict management as an alternative to violence. We planted a huge vegetable garden where a vacant house had burned down. We painted a mural beside a crumbling parking lot. And we had the kids swim every day in the Arkansas River, protected from the current inside a human chain of counselors. Doris hired me to drive the school bus. And I ran morning assembly, and she asked me to foster something like a community with that diverse group of teenagers. Early on, someone realized that every woman on the staff, everyone, had either lost a baby in miscarriage, had a child die, or had mothered an adolescent who'd run off. On some level, it was out of their shared sense of grief that the camp's vision of hope and healing was born. You see, Doris couldn't ignore the children in her dreams. She couldn't ignore the kids who lived just across town in a very different world. She couldn't ignore the ones whose schools didn't bear much resemblance to the one that her children attended. But look at Lazarus and the rich man. This nameless fellow dresses in expensive purple robes, we're told, the finest available. Moreover, because the tense of the verb to dress connotes ongoing action, the listener is to understand that he wears fancy clothing not just on special occasions, but daily. Further, the fine linen it says he wears, the Greek word is bousos, is in fact high-quality Egyptian underwear. This guy looks good from the skin out, from out in. He's a dandy. And to complete the caricature, not only is he dressed to the nines, he feasts sumptuously every day. Painted with broad strokes, this fellow is meant to be a type. He's self-centered, and he's isolated from everything but his own ego. Lazarus, on the other hand, whose name means God helps, is sick, unable to work, and presumably without extended family who could take care of him. Some involved neighbor or community member lays him at the rich man's gate each morning, knowing that the fellow has the resources to help. Again, the character is drawn bluntly to arouse the listener's emotion. Pity, this time. His open wounds, well, they're licked by the rich man's guard dogs, who feast themselves on the master's table scraps, which are thrown away, food which Lazarus could subsist on. The host and his guests, they can't miss Lazarus because they have to step over him every time they pass in or out of the house. Well, this scene is meant to disturb us, I believe. Jesus is pulling strings, appropriating elements of a story that was well known in his day. Scenes of final judgment, they might not have been the favorite, but they were quite common. The lines of good and evil are drawn with clear brushstrokes, and the moral appended, well, it can hardly be missed. Because the rich man's neglect has done violence to his erstwhile neighbor, he's judged and punished. Meanwhile, Lazarus, who knew only hardship in this life, is given rest in the bosom of Abraham, an image of intimate nurture that wouldn't be lost on the listener. Most alarming to me is the great chasm that's been fixed between the rich man and Lazarus. Now that they've been judged, there's no possibility of contact, and worse yet, no opportunity for the rich man to learn or change or grow. Aware that he's stuck, he begs for an emissary from the dead to go to his brothers so that they won't make the same selfish mistakes that he has. But Abraham says, sorry, too late. And that's the nature of folk stories. Stock characters, strict morals, misbehavior which leads to punishment. Think Brer Rabbit or The Wizard of Oz or Willy Wonka. There's a bitter truth here to be swallowed. Selfishness begets suffering on both sides of the divide. Fair enough. But I balk at the moral, which suggests that how I live now sets me up for life in the hereafter. That doesn't sound like Jesus to me. That's not how I understand the Gospels that he's given us. That's a folk tale. I've read those stories. My mama read those stories to me. I know that my behavior matters right now. I know that we can't create a real community unless we behave ourselves and act right. But ultimately, there's a scandalous story afoot that Jesus tells us, and that's that no matter how awful I might be now, I'm okay in the end. That's what made the people in Helena crazy, right? Because Claudia wanted to, not Claudia, I changed her name to protect the innocent. I'm going to call her Doris. Doris! We shouldn't record this, okay? Because they didn't want to believe that we could all be together, right? Sinners and sinners and having a party. We might figure out how to live. That's the way folk tales work, but Jesus has another idea. The gospel of Jesus is not about earning rewards in heaven. The gospel is about living with compassion now. It's about forgiveness and serving the common good. And that's why I think Jesus here is being a good English teacher. He's employing a folk tale as a rhetorical device, and he's hoping that his students, the disciples, get on board. Listen to what William Penn wrote in the 18th century. True godliness does not turn men out of the world. True godliness enables us to live better in it, and it excites our endeavors to mend it. Here's how the parable works. The gospel is about recognizing that God's in Lazarus, who lies at our doorstep, and recognizing that God's in the rich man, too, who no matter how selfish he's been, he has the potential to live a new way. How we live for the poor now, the ones inside, the ones beside us, the ones around us, that matters now. And healing happens in both directions. In an interview near the end of his life, Tennessee Williams said, "Whenever I've been hungry or scared or broke, I called on my friends, agents of the Lord, you might say, and I received from them food and drink, comfort and kindness, money, or a bed to sleep on for a time." He said, "I would have discarded, as you should also, anyone who heard a plea from a friend or a fellow human being and offered them only a prayer." He said, "Martha Graham always stated, we are the answered prayer. We are here," he says, "to move mountains and heal the sick and raise the dead. Now, in this life, for each other." I used to work at Sidwell Friends, and a former headmaster there, Bob Smith, wrote in a memoir about his experience in the Second World War. He said, "After returning, I had enormous difficulty re-entering college life, like a lot of young men in those days. He went as a teenager and came back at about 21, and he had to go back to college and start learning in the classroom, and he couldn't take that collision. It's too much. The classroom walls were almost suffocating," he said, "and the issues that seemed to bother us on the campus were trivial." So he says, "I left school and I returned to Belgium and France, where 16 months before I departed as a soldier, eager to rebuild the countries that I had so recently helped destroy. My first assignment was in the Western Belgian mining community of Beausu-Bois. I was there to help an international team of students build a community soccer field in an area covered by ugly slag heaps from the nearby abandoned coal mines. 2 years after pushing machine gun and rifle ammunition through the Ardennes forest, I now found myself 30 miles away, digging slag and hauling it away in carts from dawn till dusk. It was the hardest physical labor I'd ever done, and I'd never been so happy. It didn't feel like penance or charity. I was giving something tangible to people in need, in this case, a playing field for children recovering from war. And it was making me feel whole. The work seemed like love made visible," he said, "and yet I was the one who felt loved. Healing goes in both ways. It comes as a surprise to the rich man in the tale, but Lazarus and he are separated by a chasm of his own making. You see, the more we let ourselves know that our lives are intimately wrapped up in the ones who seem to be strangers to us, our opponents, the enemy, the poor, the wounded in our own families or farther afield, the brokenhearted and the broken down, the more we can see that we're connected, the more likely we are to embrace our own poverty and wounds and inch our way toward wholeness. You know how we bridge the chasms between us? Take the hand of the person sitting beside you. And if you're sitting by yourself, reach out, reach behind you, Margaret. You need to hold on to somebody. Everybody ought to be touching someone. Something like this can happen everywhere with anyone. It's just that intimate. We need to touch each other, and we'll stretch across those chasms that we say we have no idea how to navigate. It'll be like this, somehow or another. Is Lazarus really so different from the rich man behind the gate? Each of us needs the other to be saved. Amen.